This episode of What's the Story, Old Glory is our first looking at particular policy issues that may affect the outcome of the US presidential election this year. In our first topic, we're looking at the issue of abortion rights. And in Past Glory, we talk about Harry S. Truman.
Welcome to our latest episode of What's the Story, Old Glory. My name's Todd Muller, coming in from a beautiful Tauranga morning, and as always, my great friend and colleague, Elizabeth, where are you joining us from?
At home in Oamaru and North Otago as well, and yeah, winter's here. It's a beautiful day today, but there's a lot of snow on the Kakanui Ranges that I can see from my office, so it's a beautiful autumnal morning.
Well, we're feeling that snow in a Tauranga way here because it's quite cold. For us, at least, it was sort of 6 degrees this morning. And lots happened in the last 2 weeks in America. But as we signaled last time, we thought that this episode we would focus on one of the policy debates which looms large in this election, as it has loomed large in the American psyche for 50, 60 years. And Elizabeth, you've done some fantastic work identifying someone to participate in this today, and you led the interview, and perhaps you could just give us a quick snapshot of who we're going to have a chat to and what we are going to hear.
Yeah, so I've interviewed Dr. Prudence Flowers from Flinders University in South Australia, and we are talking about the abortion debate in America, which has this election in particular is likely to have a significant influence on the way people vote. And it was a really good interview. Dr. Flowers has done a lot of research on this issue and written many articles and is in the process of writing a book. And I just want to say that abortion is a sensitive topic for some people. And so I just want to put a warning in front of the interview before we play it that people might find some of the things we traverse slightly upsetting or triggering. So just take care of yourself if you're listening to it and find some of these issues a bit challenging.
So this is Elizabeth having a chat to Dr. Prudence Flowers on arguably one of the most divisive yet utterly engaging debates that is raging across America today.
Today I'm talking to Dr. Prudence Flowers from Flinders University in South Australia. We're very lucky to have you join us today. This is the first of our series of talking about specific policy issues that could be have a significant impact on the outcome of the 2024 US presidential election. And Dr. Flowers, if you could introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a bit about your background and expertise, that would be great. Thanks.
Hi. So my name's Dr. Prudence Flowers. I'm a senior lecturer in US history at Flinders University in South Australia. I have worked on abortion politics for quite a long time. I've primarily looked at opposition to abortion as a social and political movement, really starting from, like, my research looks from the 1960s onwards, and I've spent a lot of time in particular looking at the interrelations between modern conservatism and opposition to abortion, particularly around the presidency of Ronald Reagan, as a kind of pivot point. I have also done a bit of research around the provision of abortion and access to abortion in Australia, the US, Canada, and the UK. So I've written quite a bit about the anti-abortion movement, and I'm also now in the midst of writing, or almost finishing, I should say, a book on Reagan's presidency and the sort of transformations of modern American conservatism taking place in the 80s.
Fascinating. Thank you. So I guess we could start with a sort of a general question, particularly since you've got some comparative understanding of different approaches to abortion and these sorts of issues in different Western democratic countries, as we call them. So why is it that abortion seems to be such a major issue in US politics? It seems to dominate debate far more than it does in some of those other countries like you talked about and in New Zealand as well. So why is that?
I mean, you highlight a really important point that can be quite hard for people outside the US to kind of wrap their heads around, because the US is really unique amongst Western democracies in the what we call the politicization of abortion. So in many countries, particularly Australia, England, New Zealand as well, abortion, when it is voted on, is a matter of a conscience vote. It's not a partisan issue. And so you don't see partisan formation around abortion as a kind of way of generating votes. In contrast, since 1976, the Republican Party has kind of made opposition to abortion part of its appeal to voters. That's closely tied to Ronald Reagan. And it was a way of courting sort of what we're seeing as a new part of the electorate, religiously conservative Christian voters, so often referred to as the Christian right or the religious right. And so from 1976 onwards, it's actually been a fundamental part of federal Republican Party politics, that the party opposes abortion and supports, it used to be, supports the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So that doesn't mean that every Republican voter was anti-abortion. And in fact, the way that voters interact around abortion is really fascinating. And well into the 90s, Republicans were more likely to be pro-choice than they were to be opposed to abortion. But at a political level, the people running for office, you know, winning the White House, were increasingly very vocal in their opposition to abortion. And that tendency has really, it's not been static. So, for example, there's a moment in the mid-1990s when Bob Dole is running for the White House, and he says, to much controversy for the Christian right, that he thinks the Republican Party should be a big tent that can hold people who have different opinions on abortion. He does not win. The religious right will not vote for him. And from that point onwards, you see this swing towards ever more intense kind of anti-abortion sentiment. George Bush Jr., for example, wins the primaries because of his ability to appeal to religious right voters. So you see this kind of merging of a small but very motivated segment of the electorate who have disproportionate influence, you could perhaps say, because of non-compulsory voting.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Roe v. Wade, which is the seminal sort of case that went to the Supreme Court that affected abortion, access to abortion, abortion rights, abortion laws right across the country for a long time. Can you explain to us a little bit about that case, the decision, and why it was so significant and important?
So in January 1973, the US Supreme Court decided in a 7-2 ruling that there was a constitutional right to abortion. That is, that the right to privacy that existed within the Constitution, and we can talk more about that if you would like, extended to the decision around whether or not to have an abortion. So that decision was, you know, it doesn't come out of nowhere. There'd been a sort of wave of state-level debates changing abortion laws, but it is very dramatic. It ends up kind of changing the law in most states, like overriding reform and repeal laws that had occurred. So it is a sweeping change. It doesn't allow for abortion as an unrestricted right. Mm-hmm. It actually introduces quite a complicated trimester framework where abortion is a right that's kind of unrestricted in the first trimester of pregnancy. In the second trimester, the state can begin to impose some restrictions around what's talked about as fetal viability, and then the state has the option to ban abortion after fetal viability. So it's not an unrestricted right, but it does essentially find that there is a right to abortion in the Constitution. And one thing I'll just note there, because we were talking about other Western democracies, an interesting point of contrast is Canada, which in the 1980s, their Supreme Court essentially finds that there's a right to abortion and you can't make any laws around abortion. So unlike many other countries, Canada has no federal abortion law. And that's a different way that courts have dealt with abortion and the law and constitutions.
So I find it interesting that the amendment in the Constitution that was used for abortion was the right to privacy. People might find that a bit odd.
Let's unpack that a little bit. So there isn't actually a right to privacy in the Constitution, and this is where it gets really complicated.
Yep.
So the court had been finding for a little while that there was an implied right to privacy.
Okay.
So this had been kind of percolating in decisions, and then it's really articulated very forcefully in 1965 in the case of Griswold v. Connecticut, which is really the first time that the court spells out, yes, there is a right to privacy, and it's contained within multiple amendments, that, okay, that you have a right to privacy from governmental intrusion. And that Griswold v. Connecticut is actually the court saying that married couples have a right to access birth control. So the, like, essentially sexuality and reproduction has always been really connected to the right to privacy, and most of the kind of sexual and reproductive rights that Americans have, so the right to access birth control, the right to abortion, same-sex marriage, the right to sodomy, all of those actually do flow from the right to privacy. Interracial marriage, like, there's a whole bunch of rights that are tied up in the right to privacy, and Roe is just probably the most high-profile case. Mm-hmm.
So it's the right to privacy from state intrusion in your personal life. And so that sounds, on the face of it, like something that would be quite a sort of liberal laissez-faire kind of thing that they would support, right? Is reducing the range of things that the state can do, reducing state intervention. What was it that Ronald Reagan said? Is the worst thing is that I'm here from the federal government and I'm here to help. That's the worst thing they could say. So yeah, I just find that quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there has been, and this is kind of very well teased out, there's always been this tension, dare I say, contradiction within conservatism, particularly from the 1970s onwards in the US, where you have your sort of anti-government conservatives who, they don't want the government to tax, they don't want the government to regulate, they don't want the government really to do very much of anything, they want small government. And then people who are kind of, and sometimes those people are referred to as libertarians, although that's yep, kind of separate. But then you also have moral traditionalists who think that the government should play a role in upholding values and morals, that the government is ultimately the arbiter, does kind of have standards around, you know, who the United States is as a nation or a culture, and has a place to play in upholding those. And that's really where the religious right comes in, because what they want is the government to intervene and to intrude. And so actually you see this really fascinating constant conflict between these factions throughout the 70s, 80s, into the 90s. You have all these kind of really interesting, kind of quite ugly confrontations occurring between conservatives and within the Republican Party over, well, what is it that we think the government should and should not be doing?
So Roe v. Wade was then overturned by the Dobbs decision. So what happened there?
So in 2022, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that Roe had been sort of incorrectly decided. And the gist of it was that they said that there was no right to privacy that extended to abortion. Samuel Alito writes that draft. He's a very, he's very on the record as being very strongly anti-abortion. He was known to be very anti-abortion when he was nominated to the bench by George W. Bush. The decision was meant to be looking at a Mississippi law that imposed a 15-week gestation ban, but the decision goes much further than that case, and it overturns Roe. And the kind of crux of the matter is that it says that there's no federal right to abortion, and abortion regulation is going to be returned to the state level as it had been before Roe.
Okay, and so a lot of the popular media have sort of said that this was because of Trump that decision got made. What's the link there between the Supreme Court decision and the Trump presidency?
So Trump was able to fill three Supreme Court vacancies. Mm-hmm. One of those technically was illegitimate. That should have been an Obama nomination. But because of the maneuverings of Mitch McConnell, and congressional Republicans, there's a Supreme Court vacancy that doesn't get filled in Obama's last year in office. So Trump manages to nominate Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett during his term in office. And the reason people credit Trump with overturning Roe is because all three of those picks were very strongly opposed to abortion. And Trump had essentially promised that he would overturn Roe. Trump made a lot of promises. Trump also that he would appoint anti-abortion justices. The only thing I would say to possibly unpick that narrative is that any Republican who had won in 2016 would have done exactly the same thing, because mm-hmm. Republicans have been saying that since the judicial nomination thing is from 1980 onwards, when they've promised to appoint pro-life justices. And they've been doing that. So it's not that Trump fundamentally changes what the Republican Party is doing. He is just essentially enacting or fulfilling a promise that they have been making for over 40 years.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you talk about pro anti-abortion, pro-right to life, or whatever you want to call it, justices, because that sounds to, again, people from New Zealand, Australia, outside the US, like that's a personal moral position or a policy issue. It's not a legal issue. And to have taken a standpoint on that very publicly before even deciding a case in terms of the facts that are presented with them sounds like they'd already made up their minds.
Look, it's really, it is, again, I mean, I think even to people within the United States, the way in which judicial nominations happen now seems kind of farcical. So everyone mm-hmm. knew that those three people would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. They were all asked during the nomination process, so as part of the Senate confirmation hearings, they were all asked questions like, what is your attitude towards precedent? Which was a way of saying, do you uphold precedent? You know, do you respect the existing law of the land? And all of them said things that asserted the fact that they did uphold precedent. So, you know, on balance, everyone knew what they were going to do. Everyone interpreted what they said during judicial nominations as fudging the truth. And then they did do what everyone thought they were going to do. But the technical legal thing that makes it different from just being their opinion is that all of these justices subscribe to a theory of jurisprudence or constitutional interpretation, which is called constitutional originalism. Mm-hmm. And they, again, this is something that develops actually kind of in response to Roe v. Wade, about how judges in the contemporary setting should engage with and understand the Constitution. And this group of justices and legal scholars, the first and most important of whom was Robert Bork, essentially say that the Constitution has to be interpreted only as it's written or as the people at the time were talking about it, that you can't read anything further into it. And they contrast themselves with what's sometimes called kind of the idea of the Constitution as a living document, that you interpret it in line with the changes that have occurred since the 1780s. The one thing I will note is that although constitutional originalists make a lot of kind of claims to be engaging with the text of the document in the more respectful way, they're very flexible about how they interpret some elements of it. So there's quite a lot of legal critique about the way in which constitutional originalists interpret the Second Amendment right to guns, for example, and the way in which it really has no connection with how people talked about guns then. So it's a flexible originalism, would be my very cynical interpretation of what they're doing.
So with the Dobbs decision coming in from the Supreme Court, that essentially has moved the decision-making authority around abortion access to the state level. So what have states done in response? What has this meant in practice?
It has been a very chaotic 2 years. So many states already had laws on the books that were referred to as trigger laws, essentially waiting for Roe to be overturned. And so what that meant was that as soon as Dobbs happened, those states implemented those laws. Most of those states were essentially trying to ban abortion except in emergencies. So you also see some states then move to protect abortion rights. So the US is deeply divided right now in terms of how states handle abortion. There are 26 states plus the District of Columbia in which abortion is legal and protected. There are 14 states that essentially ban abortion except in life-threatening emergencies, or sometimes framed as to protect the life of the mother or the health of the mother. So 14 states, abortion is basically banned. And in 10 states, there are varying types of restrictions in place. Some of them have, you know, abortion is banned after 6 weeks, for example, in Florida, but that's not an outright ban, so it's not one of the 14. Or in some states, there have been attempts to ban very common abortion procedures. So it's really about 50-50 where abortion is legal versus where it's either illegal or highly regulated. And they tend to congregate in blocks. So we talk about abortion deserts in the South and in the Midwest in particular, where multiple states in a block will have almost no abortion accessible.
So what does that mean for women seeking abortions or say morning after pill, that sort of contraception? Are they able to travel to other states to get the care that they're needing? So in this, in these states where there's bans or partial bans, what happens to those women seeking treatment, people seeking abortions, or the healthcare providers if they provide such services to people? I remember Trump said something along the lines of he believed that there should be criminal prosecutions for people who have abortions outside of the law. So what does it mean for people in those states?
Right now, most states don't criminalise abortion seekers, although there are certainly some anti-abortion groups who do believe that women and pregnant people who access abortion should be charged with murder. They are kind of a radical fringe, but it's worth noting that they exist and they are out there making those arguments. So a lot of what the laws currently do are focusing on doctors, because you can... you know, you can strip doctors of their license, you can fine them, and you can send them to jail. That's what a lot of these laws do. And essentially, it's to make doctors not want to risk providing care. And we already know that this is having just like a horrific effect in emergency situations. I keep coming back to Texas, but in some ways it's because it had one of the more draconian laws before Dobbs. And so there was already this kind of huge problem on the ground there. But there was a big Texas case that's still in the works, Zaraski v. Texas, where 20 women filed suit against the state of Texas because they had been denied medical care during their complicated pregnancies. So Texas only allows abortion to save the life of the pregnant person. And so these were people who the pregnancy was jeopardizing their health and their future fertility, but it wasn't considered to have put their life at risk. And so they had to generally go interstate to access care. And, you know, similarly, this week, the Supreme Court has been hearing hearing arguments in a case around the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA. And in that, you know, there have been discussions where, so that's about the state of Idaho. You know, Idaho has said that hospitals can only provide abortion care if the woman's life is at risk. And that case, which the federal government is bringing against Idaho, you know, the federal government is putting forward cases of people who, you know, they were having a miscarriage and the hospital wouldn't act. And by the time they had the abortion, they had to have a hysterectomy at the same time. So by the time that their health was considered to be seriously jeopardized, any possibility of having another pregnancy is gone. And there's multiple examples being brought up in that case of people. I think one Idaho hospital said that they were transporting people, medevacing people interstate about once every 2 weeks because they could not provide care in their hospitals, because the assumption was that, like, essentially the woman had to be about to die for the hospital to be willing to act. So it's having this incredible chilling effect on providers and on hospitals. And that is the goal of these kind of laws, to frighten healthcare providers in particular into not offering care.
Wow. So there's also been reports in the media of that extending to IVF. Is that something to do with the status of the embryos?
Like, this is a really fascinating issue. So the Alabama Supreme Court interpreted a piece of legislation and a case to do with frozen embryos in an IVF clinic to kind of argue that frozen embryos are essentially children in the eyes of the law, that they have full personhood rights. And what's interesting there is that IVF is popular. Abortion is also popular in the United States. Like, the majority of Americans are actually pro-choice, and it's worth saying that explicitly because it can get lost in this kind of discussion. But IVF is broadly accepted by most people and most Republicans. It is not accepted by anti-abortionists because they are concerned about the destruction of embryos that aren't implanted. So they do believe that those frozen embryos are people in the eyes of the law. So anyway, Alabama essentially says that IVF is the creation of a human life, each frozen embryo, and that the destruction of those is the destruction of life and thus illegal. And that's the Supreme Court. The Alabama state legislature immediately passes laws to protect IVF, and Trump endorses those laws because IVF is politically very, very popular. But as a legal thing, what's important to note is that the anti-abortion movement has an explicit legal strategy, which is about fetal personhood and which is about attributing personhood to embryos even prior to implantation. So that personhood begins at fertilization. And so Justice Amy Coney Barrett, for example, signed on to that view when she was a Notre Dame law professor. She's endorsed that view. That is something that she believes. Neil Gorsuch has also said things about personhood before he was a Supreme Court. So that's a big legal goal of the anti-abortion movement, is to ban abortion nationwide through personhood arguments. They don't want abortion to be legal at the state level. That's not what they want. They want abortion to be completely illegal. And personhood is one strategy by which they will almost certainly try to achieve this in the long term.
Picking up a couple of things you said there, that most of the American populace at large are pro-choice, but there's this view amongst anti-abortionists that seems to just be representative of a very small group of American voters. So sort of circling back to what we said at the start, so how is it that if this is a minority held view, it has become so dominant in the discourse around this issue, both nationally and at the state levels?
So I suppose I should qualify and say, when I say a majority, I don't mean, you know, four-fifths. I mean, it's considered to be at the moment about 65% of people identify as pro-choice and pro-Roe, which is a significant majority, but it's not as pro-choice as countries like Canada and Australia and the UK and New Zealand, where there are much higher pro-choice majorities. So it's a majority, but it's not the majority. Yeah, so one thing is that support for abortion has been consistently over 50% for decades, but it has really increased as the threats on Roe became more likely. So like support for abortion kind of increased quite a lot under Trump. Once Trump was elected, in polls, people were much more clearly saying that they supported abortion rights. I think because the threat to abortion suddenly seemed very real. So to unpack why it functions as a political thing. Well, I think it's really interesting. On the one hand, abortion gets talked about a lot in every presidential election in particular. It's often talked about in like state and local elections where it has no bearing. But until very recently, we sort of said that abortion did not motivate most voters. It wasn't the deciding thing that made people vote. It was not a make or break electoral cause. So, for example, Ziad Manson, who's quite a prominent sociologist, was writing even in 2018 that for most of the public, abortion would not determine who they voted for. Dobbs does seem to have changed that, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But I think it's a twofold thing. The Republican Party has this highly motivated base, and they need to get that base out to vote. So these are people who care a lot about that issue, and they will turn out particularly in the primaries. And they will kind of favour certain types of candidates over others. So, for example, they were a bit chilly on John McCain, for example, that in the 2000s. They didn't really think he was particularly favourable to their arguments. So they're strongly motivated, and they donate a lot of money as well, and they're connected to big conservative donor groups. So I think it's a kind of interesting thing where views that don't represent the majority are really amplified through the bully pulpit and through access to politics, to the point where many of us would probably assume that most Americans favour the end of Roe, which was absolutely not the case.
So did Donald Trump deliberately court that sort of right evangelical movement and use abortion as his way in to because, you know, looking at his track record, personal life, however you want to put it on paper, one would think perhaps that he wasn't very appealing to that group. So was this the issue that he tied his campaign to as a way of getting that base to support him?
It was a pretty big issue for him. So Donald Trump has what we'll politely call a flexible attitude towards abortion, in that in the late 90s, he described himself as very pro-choice. And then at some point, although he didn't disclose it at the time, at some point he claims in the 2000s to have had a kind of epiphany and realized he opposed abortion. But he only started making that clear when he began kind of intimating he wanted to run for electoral office in the 2010s. So he referred to it as something that had happened, but he didn't talk about it or in any way associate with opponents of abortion. In 2016, he kind of went out of his way to be really extremely anti-abortion. He, Trump is good with words. He's good at being very provocative with words. And he did a lot of very provocative kind of engagement with abortion as an issue. You might remember that in 2016, during the kind of campaign against Clinton, you know, he talked about infants being killed at birth in kind of abortion rooms. He talked about abortions occurring up to the moment of birth in utero. He talked a lot in really ugly and inflammatory ways about abortion. And he was very actively courting that movement. And what's really interesting, I think, is that the anti-abortion movement is quite a politically savvy movement. They've been around for some time. They are able to wield a huge amount of influence over judicial nominations and over the Republican Party. Like, they're not idiots. And many of them kind of concluded, and I think kind of talked fairly openly about this, that they didn't need Trump to be a true believer. They just needed, he could be a conduit to what they needed. They talked about the fact that God uses unlikely vessels to deliver his will on earth. They talked in really interesting ways, like what we would view as extremely pragmatic ways. Like, they overlooked all the kind of sexual disgustingness that came to light during the 2016 campaign. They overlooked all the ways in which he did not live their values, because they didn't actually need him to be a true believer. They just needed him to deliver on his promises. And he really did. He has been by far the most successful president that movement has ever had in office. And I think it's why they will forgive a huge amount of the kind of equivocating that he's currently doing in the election, because they still think correctly that it doesn't really matter what he says, it matters what he does once he's in office. And the last time he was in office, he did basically everything that they wanted and more.
So you've mentioned before about the Dobbs decision sort of affecting voters in terms of who they're deciding to vote for potentially. And yeah, there's certainly been discussion from the, you know, the talking heads and the pundits that this could be a key issue for the 2024 election. So why is that? And we haven't talked at all really about Biden, but what's his and the Democrats' perspective on this issue?
So that's a really big and complex issue. So I'll sort of waffle on for a bit. One of the reasons that people think that abortion might matter in 2024 in a way that it hasn't in past presidential elections is because of what happened after Dobbs. So there was widely expected to be a so-called red wave backlash in the 2022 midterms, and that did not happen. People thought, you know, there's a lot of anger towards Biden about the economy and other things. Republicans are going to clean up, and it didn't happen. And that was almost solely credited to abortion by commentators and by people who analyzed polling and voter kind of sentiment. There was believed to be widespread voter anger about Dobbs. There was a real rush from young people and from women to register to vote. Again, in the aftermath of Dobbs, there was a huge flood of people who, you know, it's non-compulsory voting, so people don't always vote, who turned out and who wanted to register to vote. And for a brief kind of moment, you were seeing like 15-20% of registered voters claiming that abortion was one of their like top issues that they would be thinking about when they were voting. So all of that's kind of unprecedented. Normally the big things that determine how people vote are basically the economy, sometimes defense, but normally the economy. And also, you know, abortion was credited with, you know, Democrats managed to win Virginia, which is a kind of state that goes back and forth. And that was, again, credited to the abortion politics of some of the key people running for office in that kind of particular election. And there have been multiple referendums at the state level about abortion rights or opposition to abortion. All of those have favoured abortion rights, even in traditionally Republican states like Kansas and Ohio and Kentucky. So at the ground level, voters are behaving in unusual ways when it comes to abortion as a kind of mobilizing and clarifying issue. Biden is really capitalizing on anger with Republicans. So this has been, you know, Biden is not personally popular and he hasn't been personally popular as a president, but he has been talking about abortion and using abortion very explicitly since Dobbs. I mean, I don't want that to sound cynical. The Biden administration has also done a few, as much as it can, I think you can say, to shore up abortion rights, given this new landscape. But as an electoral issue, Biden and Kamala Harris have really been positioning themselves, as have most congressional Democrats, as the defenders of abortion rights. And they are really highlighting what they describe as the barbarity and the inhumanity of Republican laws. So Biden has been really drawing attention to things like Florida's 6-week abortion ban, or Kamala Harris is bringing in abortion doctors and they're sort of testifying about not being able to provide care to people whose bodies are shutting down almost, you know, that kind of thing. So for Democrats, abortion was really identified in late 2023 as the issue that would be front and center for them. And there have been consistent media events and statements and actions where Democrats and Biden and Harris are highlighting what has happened after Dobbs and blaming Republicans for it. And in particular, you know, so Trump made this somewhat unusual video on Truth Social a few weeks ago, where he took credit for Roe, but also said it was a state issue. Sorry, he took credit for the end of Roe and then said that it needed to be a state issue, not a federal issue, and all this other stuff. But what Biden got from that, and why people think that video might have been a little bit damaging, was Trump taking credit for the end of Roe. And so they've been really hammering Republicans and Trump for, you know, the cruelty that's unfolding on the ground.
So do you think this is going to continue for the rest of the election, that, you know, we'll see it as an issue in the debates and that sort of thing?
Yes, I do. I think, so Trump on the one hand is behaving in really interesting ways. So he has been doing all kinds of things that upset opponents of abortion because he is refusing to endorse a federal 15-week ban, which is something that some elements of the movement have been calling for. Trump's former vice president, Mike Pence, is a strong advocate for this idea of a congressional 15-week ban. And Trump won't endorse it. Trump has essentially been saying that he thinks it's an issue that needs to be returned to the states, which is also problematic when really chaotic things are happening at the states, like Arizona's Supreme Court upholding an 1864, a law from during the Civil War era as abortion. Like, the states are a very tumultuous place, and Trump is saying, let the states deal with it, which in some ways is also a bit problematic for him. But simultaneously, so Trump's sort of saying, I won't do what the anti-abortion movement wants. I'm going to let the states do it. I've done enough. But, you know, I think Trump would prefer to not have to talk about abortion very much. He wants to call himself the person who overturned Roe, but he doesn't really want to have to associate himself with what's happening at the state level. And he is really blaming or holding Republicans at the state level as responsible for the kind of mess that's unfolding. For example, you know, last year, he criticized, and this was seen as really unusual, he criticized Florida's six-week ban and kind of implied that it went too far, that it was too extreme. You know, that was also a way of having a go at his rival, Governor Ron DeSantis. But still, he's criticizing a six-week ban when there are 10 states that have total bans. Like, you know, he's really behaving in interesting ways. But this is, I think, because he's trying to make voters just assume that he is somehow separate to the anti-abortion movement, that there's nothing that he'll do once he's in office, that he's just going to leave it at a state level. And I absolutely do not think that that would be what happens if he were to win the White House. There are an array of federal things that he could do to really damage abortion rights and access, and would do that. So Trump, I think, would like to not have to talk about abortion too much. Biden would like to talk about abortion quite a lot. I think both of them are going to have to talk about abortion quite a lot because the Supreme Court has been hearing arguments in the last month on two separate abortion-related cases, and both of those decisions are expected to come down in June. So they are again going to have to talk about abortion. So it will definitely continue as an issue. The question is whether or not it's going to be a make or break issue for voters, and that is something we genuinely don't know.
Particularly in those swing states.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth noting, like, a place like Arizona, which recently the Supreme Court upheld this 1864 total ban, which freaked all the Arizona Republicans out. So they've just passed a law saying, no, 15-week ban, that's all we want. We don't want to ban it. Arizona narrowly went to Biden in the last election, and that's only the third time that a Democrat has won that state. Arizona has Senate seats up for grabs. You know, these things will matter in swing states, and they'll also potentially matter kind of broadly in terms of the national mood and how people view Republican governance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you want to bring up, discuss?
Can I talk about some anti-choice things that Trump might do if he's in office?
Absolutely. Yeah, go for it.
So I think it's easy to assume that there is nothing further that can be done by anti-choice forces at the moment at a federal level. But one thing that I think is very dangerous and very real right now is that there's a law on the books at the federal level called the Comstock Law. It was passed in 1873, so it's really old. It hasn't been enforced for quite a long time. So the Comstock Law essentially bans the sending of obscene materials through the mail, but obscene materials here were explicitly defined as birth control and abortion devices. So this is a kind of 19th century anti-contraception, anti-abortion measure. It has not been enforced for a really long time, obviously. Opponents of abortion believe that Trump could, essentially with the stroke of a pen, mandate that law back into effect, and that would obviously have a disastrous effect on, for example, can doctors get early medication abortion sent to them by courier through the mail? What about surgical devices? Like, what would it extend to contraception? You know, that is a very real issue right now. Trump has not said anything about it. It is certainly something that anti-abortion opponents are very fixated on right now. Similarly, you know, they are trying to push to not allow early medication abortion to be sent via telehealth. We have telehealth here in Australia where you can access medication abortion under 9 weeks gestation. During COVID, that became kind of the norm in the US as well. And opponents of abortion are working really hard to try and prevent that, because access to posted medication abortion is one way that people in states with abortion bans can access abortion care. Like, that is how people in Ireland, for example, were accessing abortion care in the 21st century before the Eighth Amendment was repealed. So early medication abortion has been a really important way that people have continued to have essentially safe abortion care in illegal contexts. Opponents of abortion want to stop that. They want to stop that immediately. Opponents of abortion want to see doctors criminalized if they provide abortion care to out-of-state patients. You know, there are all these ways in which, even if they can't get, you know, a fetal personhood amendment in place, you know, in the next few years, they can dramatically strip away even the fragile rights that currently exist. And it is a really alarming prospect on a whole range of fronts.
So is there evidence that now or in the future, if some of these other, if that law, for instance, Trump was to executive order it back into usage, that dangerous abortions and contraception, types of contraception, will be used outside of medical settings, as used to happen?
Look, that's a really interesting question. So in some ways, the advent of early medication abortion, which kind of was legalized in the US in 2000, I think, it's been around since the 1980s, that's fundamentally changed what illegal abortion looks like internationally. So the existence of those drugs has radically altered how people access illegal abortion. And so in some ways, the kind of what many of us think of as the really dangerous, barbarous kind of surgical abortion past are not a phenomenon, because most people access abortion care early in their pregnancy. So the vast majority of inseminations throughout the Western world happen in the first trimester. And to be honest, even if the US successfully bans early medication abortion being posted within it, I can almost guarantee that either through Mexico or Canada or land routes or other ways, people would smuggle it in. That's how the medication was getting into Ireland, for example. And we know that abortion activists in Ireland were importing large amounts of early medication abortion and distributing it. Again, this is kind of activism that dates back to the 90s and the 2000s. There used to be, there probably still is actually, a group called Women on Web that allowed people to buy illegal abortion pills if they couldn't legally access them. So I think we wouldn't see the kind of landscape of septic abortions that we saw pre-Roe. But I do think we would see contexts in which pregnant people would be increasingly criminalized. And, you know, there's already situations where that is occurring, where women present at emergency rooms miscarrying or having, perhaps a miscarriage in the second trimester, and they are treated in an adversarial, accusatory, like people have been charged and accused of trying to bring on an abortion. And honestly, it normally tends to be women of color and people of minorities who have these kinds of experiences in emergency rooms. So I think what you would see is that people having miscarriages or having medicated abortions would be having these kind of experiences in hospital settings that would be very damaging to their health and their essentially their kind of mental well-being. I think it would lead to really, really great kind of surveillance and suspicion towards women presenting at hospital wards having miscarriages, whether those were, you know, genuine miscarriages or abortions or whatever. I think what we would see is this kind of shift almost towards where hospitals become a kind of front line of policing, which would be a disastrous consequence for all women of reproductive.
Well, Elizabeth, when I listen to our podcasts after we do them, because, you know, sometimes I do that, I find that we use words like fascinating and extraordinary quite a lot. But it's very hard sometimes when we're doing podcasts to find words that sort of summarize accurately the interviews that we've just had. That was something else, wasn't it? I mean, thoughts?
Yeah, it was. I found it really interesting. I have done a bit of research myself in previous years when I was at university on the abortion issue, particularly Roe v. Wade. But Dr. Flowers' insights were just, as you say, fascinating. She's such an expert in the area, and I learnt a lot. And it's going to be really interesting to see how this issue plays out in the upcoming election. As she said, it seems that it's going to have more of an influence on the way people vote than it has before, and that comes down to the Dobbs decision, and subsequently what that's meant in states for states and women who are in those states that have got severely curtailed access to abortion, contraception, and emergency treatment. It's very sobering.
It is. You know, obviously I'm a former politician and had spent 9 years in Parliament, including an MP, when those debates in a New Zealand context around abortion access were held. Very passionate, you know, significant number of contributors to the Select Committee process, as you would expect. This is an issue that very few people don't have an opinion on, for obvious reasons. And we, you know, voted as a parliament to broaden access and change it from essentially a criminal framing in terms of the legislation that abortion had been enabled under to a health framing. It was passed. It was passed comfortably. And then after the debate, you move on. And as a parliamentarian in the debate, it literally, you passed, there was lots of applause for those, you know, celebrating the victory. And then the next item on the order paper turns up and we start debating that. And society moves on. In America, it's the complete opposite, isn't it? I mean, this has been obviously Roe versus Wade, that was 1972. 73. And so here we are, you know, 51 years later, and the country is utterly riven about this issue, constantly sending it back to the courts and the Supreme Court to decide whether this indeed is something that should be enabled under federal law or under state law. But the effect of changing it from a federal right, essentially, to states to decide, you know, for those states where, you know, those 14 states where rights have been seriously curtailed, you know, it's exceptionally sobering. Whichever, you know, whatever personal view people hold about these things, it's quite remarkable that in 2024, this is what is going on in America.
Yeah. And Dr. Flowers said, the evangelical right in America in particular have been really wanting this issue to be brought front and center back to the Supreme Court since the Roe v. Wade decision was made all those years ago, and it's been something that they've been working hard on. Trump was sort of like the final person that they were able to use to be able to get what they wanted through the Supreme Court. But like she said, Trump was just regardless of who the Republican candidate was, they would have put up their own conservative justices to the Supreme Court, and so probably would have had the same effect. But it's going to turn into a long game for those who are vehemently pro-choice and want this to be a federal right that women have to be able to access abortion, also contraception. In some states it extends to issues around contraception and medical care for miscarriages and things like that, where women essentially have to have some form of treatment. And if the staff and facilities aren't available to be able to provide that, then it seriously affects people's health and potentially their lives.
Absolutely. And then, you know, the conversation about IVF under threat, conversation that even potentially looking forward, if Trump gets elected, you know, quite extraordinary restrictions on even to be able to send information about options being banned. I shake my head. And the other element that came into stark relief for me was how politicised the Supreme Court appointments are. I mean, it is one thing having a constitution and then having a Supreme Court to sit in judgment of cases brought forward to test where the constitution starts and finishes in terms of the impact on people's lives. But then to have, you would then hope that the seven men and women that sit around that table are the best and brightest, but actually it's all about where they sit on these sorts of issues. Are they pro-life? Are they pro-choice? And depending on those sort of moral issues, that is the first order reflection as to whether Senate and Congress endorses them to become, appointed to the Supreme Court or not. Not their legal jurisprudence or history or how talented they are as a legal mind. That is well down the order. I find that just, I just simply don't understand it. If you have a constitution, you have a Supreme Court, ideally you find the best seven you can to sit on that Supreme Court. That's the whole point of it.
And the Supreme Court decisions that come out, whether you agree with them, depending on which side of the spectrum you sit on, they pretty much always they decide the constitutionality of the cases that come before them very much on a policy basis. Like very few of them actually come down to jurisprudential legal reasoning. It's often policy dressed up as such.
Yes.
Because of the nature of the issues that get brought forward as much as anything else, but also, of course, because of the political nature of the appointments that get made. So there have been louder and louder calls for reform of the Supreme Court in terms of its makeup, how the justices are appointed, length of term, because there are no term limits on the justices, but whether it needs to be expanded and that kind of thing. So those are becoming more and more vocal. And we saw big protests outside the Supreme Court on Capitol Hill in Washington just this week around the case that they're hearing as to whether Trump should be immune from prosecution, and that would extend to all presidents in theory. And arguments have been made on that case and will be coming out forthwith.
Yes, it's hard not to think that term limits wouldn't be a smart thing. As one of the things that could perhaps be the easiest to deal with. I mean, they have term limits in presidents, and that's a good thing because, I'm a great supporter in many respects of Ronald Reagan, but he would have won in a landslide in 1988 if he'd stood for a third term. But he was clearly too old, although we've touched on the age of presidential candidates before. Clinton easily would have won a third term. Obama would have won a third term. And of course, since Franklin Delano Roosevelt's time, two terms is it. And you certainly could see an argument that says, by the time you're 70, you need to step down. And so that would create, I think, a different dynamic, because certainly they would turn up, that the vacancies would occur more frequently. Trump had a remarkable luck, in inverted commas. Those who vehemently disagree with the Supreme Court's recent rulings would see it in different terms. But, he could appoint three out of seven. When I say he could, I mean because of the president nominates, of course, Congress and Senate have to approve. But of course, the Republicans had control of the Senate and the Congress at the time. So essentially, there was a open door for three very conservative justices to get put in. Remarkable.
And regardless of how controversial those characters are, like Brett Kavanaugh, I mean, his approval hearings were very controversial, and a lot of issues came up around what he did in college and that sort of thing, and potential sexual assault. But still got appointed. So yeah, it's a interesting
for
process.
Life. For life. Okay, well, brilliant interview. Thank you very much. And let's move on to past glories.
Yes. Who are we profiling today?
Well, one of my favourite presidents, actually. He was the 33rd president of the United States. Harry S. Truman. And the reason I chose him is, well, partly because he's one of my favourites. When I was, as people know, as a young fella, I got the World Book Encyclopedias when I was about 11 and read them. I can't say I read all the encyclopedias cover to cover, but I certainly did each one of the presidential segments. And Harry Truman always sort of caught my eye. A sort of a surprising president in many respects. He was born in 1884 in Lamar, Missouri. Fought in World War One, despite having a very, very poor eyesight, had sort of bottle thick glasses from the age of eight, but managed to, you know, get himself into an opportunity to contribute in the war. Was very keen to enlist and fight over for the Allies, and he did, and saw action and honour in France. Came back and set up a men's clothing store, and unfortunately it failed, as many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of businesses did in post the war. There was a sort of a mini depression in the early 1920s, and he got caught up with that recession rather than depression, I think. But he showed in that, for me, a very, very high level of integrity. He spent the next 15 years paying off the debts that he owed to people for the loss of his menswear company. And, you know, that sort of contrasts a bit with perhaps other presidential candidates in history who have had challenges with their finances and have just basically walked away from any obligation they may have had. So I was very impressed with that. The other the reason is just such a different world. He decided that he wanted, after his failure in business, if you like, he decided he wanted to get into politics, and became friends with a guy called Tom Prendergast, who was a Democratic city boss in Kansas City, Missouri. And back in those days, to become a politician, it was all about who you knew in the machine, really. And the Democratic machine was very much union boss dominated. Of course, the GOP, the Republican, it was all very much those who had large business connections. But he was obviously a Democrat, and he was supported by the Prendergast machine to firstly stand as a local county judge, and then for senator for Missouri. So he went from a county judge straight into being a senator in Missouri on the back of the support of essentially smoke-filled rooms. And I just wanted to do a bit of a contrast with what happens in today's world, where if you look across the American political system at the moment, particularly the last few months, it's been primary season, where both senators have often been, who are up for re-election, have been challenged by some people in their own party and have had to run off against them to be the nominee for the upcoming November elections. Same thing happened in the for many, many Congress seats. This never happened back in the 1930s. It was smoke-filled rooms where people decided, party bosses decided who would be our candidate. And there was a lot of corruption, a lot of backhanded, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. We're going to put this person in to be our senator and our interests will be protected. The reason I give that sort of background is it's quite different in many respects from today, although arguably, without perhaps drawing too strong a longer bow, we have a similar sort of environment, I think, with Trump, particularly in the Republican Party, where he is sort of like the boss of the Republican Party, and who he says should be the candidate often gets the primary nod in individual states, notwithstanding the fact that the average person, if you like, participates a lot more than they clearly did back in the 1930s. But then Senator Harry S. Truman led a charge as a senator to clean up corruption in government contracts. Particular focus on the railroads was his area that he really drove hard. But it ended up with Tom Prendergast and a number of his associates and friends all being sent to jail for corruption. So the very machine that had put Harry S. Truman in to into the Senate, once he was there and as part of, you know, in an attempt by senators to clean up the American political system, he led that, and he led that with great integrity, and including people that he knew very well. They ended up, you know, being put in jail. And that sort of integrity you don't actually see a lot of nowadays, in my view, in a political context in America. He was then selected to be vice president in 1944 for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Roosevelt, obviously, America was in war. It was coming to the end of the war, but Roosevelt decided that he wanted, that he needed to finish the job and stand for an unbelievable fourth term, which he got into. But he was very ill, and those, you know, Democratic leaders knew he was ill and unlikely to serve out his full term. So whoever the vice president was going to be critical. They chose Harry Truman over the incumbent vice president, Henry Wallace, who was seen as too liberal and a threat to segregation. Harry Truman became vice president, and on April the 12th, when President Roosevelt died, became president. I was, you know, reflecting, I could spend half an hour talking about what happened whilst President Truman was in office. The most substantive decision, first decision, wasn't the establishment of the United Nations, in and of itself a remarkable thing, but clearly the decision to drop two atomic bombs on Japan. He signed that off as the president, and is part of infamous history because of it. He set up NATO. He drove hard the Marshall Plan, which was the rebuilding of Japan and particularly Europe, Western Europe after the war. Obviously involved in Korea, Korean War occurred under his watch. Quite a remarkable series of international and domestic events that he saw as president. But the one bit that I wanted to touch on before we finish of this segment of past glories is the 1948 election, where no one gave him a chance. Every single poll had him behind, and behind by double digits. And he was up against a Republican candidate who was just the epitome of smooth. His name was Thomas E. Dewey, and ran a very, very catchy campaign slogan of, "Well, do we or don't we?" Which you think you could, you know, perhaps have come up with something slightly better than that. But anyway, he was expected to win in a landslide because, you know, you put it in the context that had 12 years now of, 16 years of essentially the same president. You know, it was Roosevelt for 12 and then his vice president for the last four. So everyone assumed that Truman would lose, except for Truman himself. And he did. He decided that he did two things which I thought were very smart. Firstly, he was his Republican opposition had won the Congress for the first time in about 40 years in 1946. So it was a Congress-controlled, Republican-controlled Senate and Congress. So they nominated Dewey, put their campaign out, and said they were going to do all these, you know, incredibly, inspirational, progressive issues that were going to help Americans. And so President Truman decided, this is in the middle of the campaign, really, at the start of the campaign, to call an emergency session of Congress and say, well, okay, you say that you campaign on these progressive areas. I'm ordering you back to Washington to go into session. You have the majority. You go and pass them. Do it now. Don't wait till next year. Do it now. And of course, the Republicans flubbed because they didn't really intend to do all these things. They just wanted to campaign on how tired Truman was and look at, you know, what we'd like to do over the next 4 or 8 years. So he called their bluff and I thought quite brilliantly. And of course, the Republicans didn't progress any of the issues that they said they were campaigning on. So he immediately called them a do-nothing Congress, hopped on the back of a train and did 50,000 kilometers on a train, 350 speeches. And basically in it, they say in Time magazine, a particularly earthy style. So you can imagine what that's like. His basically his slogan was, give them hell, Harry. And that's what he did. He gave them hell. And I'll put it in our promos for this episode. But so confident was the newspapers of the day that Dewey had won. There's this famous picture of from the Chicago Tribune, which says Dewey defeats Truman, and Truman holding up the paper with a big smile on his face. Truman wins by 303 electoral votes. He got to about 235, I think, for Dewey. So remarkable, and still seen in American history as the most remarkable election win, totally against that. There wasn't a single poll that had Harry Truman winning, but ultimately he did, and he won the popular vote. And it was accredited to his remarkable earthy campaign style and the fact that he got the vote out. And people who no one really thought would vote in the middle of the country, they all turned out and voted and got him across the line. So Harry S. Truman, the S doesn't stand for anything, that his parents just thought it would look good on his birth certificate. And 33rd president, I think a remarkable man and a reflection of perhaps America as it used to be, and perhaps not so much of America as it is today.
Yeah, wow. I didn't know all that about him. Thank you. That's really interesting. Sounds like he was a brilliant strategist, both in terms of campaigning and also in terms of how he ran his office as president. It also seems like that was the start of the sort of hawkish foreign policy position that America was known for the rest of the 20th century. Seems to have started under Truman. Would that be fair?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, the challenge is that the world looked so different at the end of World War II, right? America was a singularly largest economy, the most wealthiest economy. I think at one level, what America did post-World War II was immensely counterintuitive, right? We talked before about in our previous episodes that America had historically under the Monroe Doctrine been very focused on their sphere of influence in America and not particularly interested in Europe, had to be dragged, many would argue, into the war in 1917 and First World War, and then immediately retreated back to America and had nothing to do with really what was going on in Europe the subsequent 20 years. That did not happen after World War II. They stayed in Japan and very much rebuilt it. They stayed in Western Europe and rebuilt it. Now, of course, there was the countervailing pressure now of the immediate threat of the Soviet Union post the Second World War. But they very much acknowledged that they needed to stay in world affairs in a preeminent role. And I think that was supported strongly by the population, and particularly the scale of American involvement in World War II across both the Pacific Front and the European theater, was that all those returning servicemen, they were very much of the view that you don't do all of this bloodshed and loss to then just retreat from the world stage and let the next dictator come and take over, where you have to go and do it all again. And so really seared by the experience of the First and then Second World War. So whether that equals hawkish foreign policy, not sure. I think it certainly meant that they felt that they needed to be in the world stage. And of course, the immediate Cold War that started between them and the Soviet Union meant that really the next 60 years was going to be an arm wrestle, both for good and ill, as many countries at the sort of margins had to experience.
Wow, that was fantastic. Thank you. Really enjoyed that. Love these discussions about US history and policy and where politics and geopolitics collide. It's really, really interesting. I could sit here all day and do it.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing is that you know, when you study this at university, particularly, you know, I did in the late 1980s, as the Cold War finished and America was triumphant and the West was triumphant, I never did I ever think that you would fast forward to 2024 and be having the conversations we've been having about even today, Roe v. Wade. You know, you go back, I know that the conservatives were certainly had a plan, and Prudence talked to us about that. But, you know, it was such a different world in America in 1989, 1990. George Herbert Walker Bush, the president, yes, he was conservative, but America was focused on free trade, and they were absolutely the dominant global policeman, strongly supportive of NATO, strongly supportive of the United Nations, the WTO. I mean, on we go, right? And it's just to then say, oh, well, you fast forward 35 years and America's going to be, you know, completely tipped on its head. Russia invading Ukraine and China, the, you know, a dominant force in the world threatening Taiwan. Wow, wouldn't have picked it. That's what makes geopolitics and politics generally so exciting.
Yeah, well, it was around that time that that famous book was published by Fukuyama, The End of History. Like,
yes,
it seemed like that was it. This was going to be the world from now on.
Liberal democracies.
Wow, things have changed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Apparently, liberal democracies like ours had won, and I do find that interesting. I think that's perhaps a worthwhile reflection from New Zealand generally, that, you know, we have our challenges, but we have been immensely blessed as a country in terms of our institutions and the way of life we get to lead. It's most countries in the world don't experience it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Well, on that note, we should probably bring this episode to a close. It's been a long one, but a fascinating one, and really enjoyable to bring to our listeners. So, we will continue our series on policy issues that are going to be important for the election over the next few months. Everything from gun control to the economy to the so-called culture wars. So it's going to be a fun ride, all while keeping more than one eye on Trump's criminal trials that will be unfolding right throughout the election campaign too.
And the polls, which seem to suggest that none of this really matters. So until we meet again, haere rā from me, Todd Muller.
And from Elizabeth Soul, mā te wā.
What's the Story Old Glory is written, produced, edited and presented by Elizabeth Soul and Todd Muller for Old Glory Casting. Our cover art is by Caitlin at Studio Naylor. Our theme music is Shootout at Sundown by Del Boni. You can find us on all the usual social media channels at Old Glory Pod, and send us your questions to oldglorypod@gmail.com.